Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New York Times reported in January that the political network overseen by the conservative billionaires Charles and David Koch plans to spend close to $900 million on the 2016 campaign. This puts their contributions on a par with the total spending of both the Democratic and Republican parties. Gary Hart, the former U.S. Senator from Colorado and presidential contender, writes in his latest book, The Republic of Conscience, that this is not what the founding fathers intended campaigns to be, that campaigns that cost billions and are controlled by narrow interests are antithetical to their ideas. The book is published by Blue Rider Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Gary Hart back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back.
Now, you've taken the title of your book from a poem by Seamus Heaney. You've been spending a fair amount of time in Ireland. So are you reading Irish poets these days?
Not just these days. I've read Yeats all my life and discovered Heaney in rather late in life. I have been active in Northern Ireland on behalf of John Kerry in recent months. But I also used to go to the west of Ireland and write books.
Now, his poem is called From the Republic of Conscience, and you quote a few lines from the beginning of your book. No porters, no interpreter, no taxi. You carried your own burden, and very soon your symptoms of creeping privilege disappeared. At their inauguration, public leaders must swear to uphold unwritten law and weep to atone for their presumption to hold office. Now, he was Irish. Does this also apply to the character of American leaders?
Yes, it does. In fact, I had written the book and was searching for a title and ran across this poem entitled The Republic of Conscience. And a chill went up my spine because it fits so well. The book is about recapturing the classic definition of a republic, which our founders created, and restoring integrity to government.
And you're right that the founding fathers knew when they created a republic that if they look back to Athens and Rome, it would be vulnerable to corruption, which takes the form of narrow individual and special interests.
Yes.
So human nature never changes.
It doesn't. And that kind of corruption was the death of all republics previous to ours. And Ben Franklin said this: we've created a republic if you can keep it. And the idea of this kind of corruption, not bribery, money under the table, but special interests over the common good, really worried them.
But don't the Koch brothers, for example, claim that they have a libertarian vision and that's the reason they're willing to spend all that money? In the case of Sheldon Adelson, it has to do with mostly his support of Israel.
Well, up until the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, most people would have said there should be constraints on the amount of money any individual or interest can contribute. And as you well know, we've had cycles of campaign reform, finance reform, and we keep trying to keep big money from dominating our politics. But the Supreme Court has legalized this kind of corruption.
McCain-Feingold was supposed to have a real impact, but it never seemed to really have one.
It did for a while, and it really, I claim a bit of credit. Before the two of them invented this, I was an early advocate in the 70s of campaign finance reform because I saw the genie getting out of the bottle even at that time, and that led to McCain-Feingold, and it worked for a while till it began to be eroded.
Do you remember how much money you had to raise in 1975 when you first ran for the Senate?
74. In a contested six-way primary against a two-term incumbent, I raised and spent $375,000.
And that was it?
That was it. $17 average contribution.
But I suspect your opponents weren't raising all that much more.
Well, the incumbent that I defeated spent probably four or five times that. 6 years later, when I ran for re-election, I had to raise and spend $1 million, three times that amount, and I was outspent.
Politicians complain that so much of their time is spent raising yes. funds when they could be doing much more important work.
Absolutely true. And colleagues, former colleagues of mine say they go to the party headquarters, both parties, 2 hours a day and do nothing but make fundraising phone calls.
Do you believe that the role of money in elections is the main corrupting force, or are there other equally powerful factors?
It's all connected, as I argue in the book, with the explosive growth of the lobbying industry, and it is an industry. It's now a $4 billion annual industry. Over 400 former members of Congress are now lobbyists.
Should they be restricted from entering lobbying at least for a time?
Like 25 years. A year or two at least.
Yeah, but they go right from their office in the Senate of the House and into a lobbying firm.
They do, and make a lot of money.
Why is there a refusal to enact strict campaign finance reforms in Congress, or is that a silly question?
Oh, I've never recall receiving a silly question from you.
No, but I mean, maybe that question answers itself.
Well, when the highest court in the land legitimizes corporations as individuals under the First Amendment and then permits them to spend unlimited amounts of money pursuing their own particular interest, the cat is out of the bag. It's legalized corruption.
One of the biggest expenses for a campaign is television ads.
Yes.
Wasn't there an idea in the past about offering free airtime on the networks for
yes.
political advertising?
It's an argument I've made all for the last 30 or 40 years. The airwaves, as you well know, belong to the American people. They don't belong to NBC or anyone else. They're licensed by the people of the United States through the government. So we can require electronic media, not print, but electronic media to make time available, as they do in most European democracies. But once again, the television lobby in America is too powerful.
Also, European campaigns tend to be much shorter.
Yes.
We could shorten ours. So right now, we are in the midst of intense campaigning, and we're over a year and a half away from the next election.
Yeah. Self-interest requires me to resist calendar limitations because dark horse candidates, less well-known, need a long time in a country this size to get better known, and that was my experience.
Bernie Sanders, obviously,
yes.
trying that kind of campaign. Why doesn't spending by liberals like George Soros and Tom Steyer simply balance out the spending by wealthy conservatives like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson?
I think you'd have to do the mathematics, which I have not done, between liberal progressive contributors and conservative. But so much of this money is corporate money, and no one has believed that corporations end up on the liberal side of the spectrum. So I expect that in terms of balance, it's heavily weighted towards conservatism.
Well, Hillary Clinton's campaign is now estimated to cost perhaps $1.3 billion. So Democrats are also going after that kind of money, and they probably have to go after the same kinds of contributors.
Well, shame on them. This is not a partisan book. This is a systemic book that's about the whole system. There have been people in the Clinton campaign say they may spend as much as $2.5 billion.
Wow. In the wake of the Charleston shooting, there's a new political will to remove Confederate flags from public spaces. But it's been pointed out again and again, there's been no meaningful conversation about gun control. And when you look at the spending on lobbying and contributions in 2013, 2014 by gun rights groups, it's $31 million, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. In your own state, Colorado, weren't some legislators punished by voters for supporting a gun control measure in the wake of the Aurora movie killings?
Oh, they were. They were recalled, and state legislators, two or three of them, and dismissed from office on this issue. As you well know, this is the single issue constituency of America. That's the members of the NRA care only about gun control, nothing else.
But if other people want gun control, then how come those legislators were recalled? Obviously, voters are going along with the NRA,
or not voting. A lot of people will tell pollsters that they want gun control and then not turn up when the votes are counted.
Well, shame on them, then.
Shame on them.
My guest is Gary Hart, whose latest book is The Republic of Conscience. What do you imagine that Washington, Adams, Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson, among others, would think of the American Republic today?
They'd be appalled. I think just reading what they said to each other, what they wrote, what they argued, they really genuinely feared this form of special interest corruption. So they would have to be appalled.
Well, they were at that time when they wrote the Constitution, Supreme Court didn't have the kind of role in politics it has today. But the Supreme Court over the years has been both a positive and a negative force in American politics.
Yes. But the court only came along recently in Citizens United and other opinions to ratify a corrupting system, if you will, that was well underway. And the issue was, would the Supreme Court ratify this corruption and the explosive growth of it and the combination with campaign finance, or would they resist it? And they ratified it.
The founding fathers, you write, anticipated that there would be special interests, but they hoped that elected officials would think about the national interest.
They called it the common good, which comes from ancient Athens.
So has that idea just been lost?
It
probably was lost fairly early in the American democracy.
I think more in the 20th century with the rise of dominant special interests. I'm a student of American history, but I'm not Arthur Schlesinger. But you
do have a doctorate in political theory.
From Oxford, yes. Mm.
So you know all about British political theory?
No, I wrote about Thomas Jefferson to the amusement of the Brits. No, I'm still not Arthur Schlesinger. What I'm saying is that in my lifetime, since I served in the 70s and 80s, this systemic corruption has occurred. Now, we have always had lobbyists, that you can't outlaw lobbying. But you can control the connection between the lobbyists and the financing of campaigns. That can be controlled.
Well, it's just the name, the lobbyists. They used to wait in the lobby.
Yes.
They're not waiting in the lobbies anymore.
They are not. And I will tell you a tipping point in my own life. In 1979, I was getting ready to run for re-election. A group of Coloradans came in, brought in by the Washington representative of their organization. And when they left, after a nice discussion, my administrative assistant brought in an envelope, and in it was a check for $2,000 for my reelection campaign. I had him run down the hall and give it back to them. I was not going to require people to make a contribution to talk to me. And that, to me, and I was dumbfounded. And that was the beginning of this system.
You write that the first principles of every constitution must be frequently renewed to prevent corruption. How would that work?
In all kinds of ways. A non-binding constitutional convention. Schools teaching civics again. Parents telling their children what it means to live in a country like this. We use the language of democracy, but our founders used the language of the republic. A democracy is about rights. A republic is about duties. And we are not learning the duties of citizenship.
But there were fears of real democracy in the early days of the nation.
There were. Adams and Hamilton saw democracy as mobs in the street. Jefferson kind of liked the ideas, did Madison. But the founding debate was all conducted with the language of the republic and the sense of duty, commonwealth, resistance to corruption.
The founding fathers couldn't have anticipated the era of globalization as it has developed. what do you think that they would think of it?
Who knows?
Well, of course, we were talking about no entangling alliances in those days.
Yes. Well, we've gone well beyond that, as I document in the book. But
the reason I ask is you write, globalization indeed has led to the commercialization of the U.S. diplomatic system.
Yes. Well, our embassies since the end of the Cold War are, I think, frankly, to the good, helping American companies carry out activities abroad, including healthcare and a whole variety of other things. So that's not bad. What I'm trying to argue is not that lobbying per se is bad or that commerce per se is bad. That's not going to change. The founders, to respond to your question, were pragmatists. They would have adapted our policies to the age of globalization and information and so forth. But there's a big difference between policy and principle.
Well, one of the things I see as similar is that people were stuck very strong to their ideologies.
Yes.
And that was at the beginning, and we're seeing it today. The fact that the import-export bank is now in danger of extinction has more to do with ideology than it has to do with any practical thing.
Well, in recent years, I can't account again for 19th and 20th century. Recent years, the polarization of the nation, largely brought on by gerrymandering into red and blue states, and the polarization of the parties, particularly on the right, by Tea Party influences and a collection of social conservatism interests, has dominated American politics, and it's been financed by the kind of corruption that I've talked about here.
Why do you think Occupy hasn't had more of a lasting impact?
The same reason gun control advocates aren't as visible as gun owner advocates.
My guest is Gary Hart, former U.S. senator and presidential candidate, author of 21 books, including his doctoral thesis. 2001, was that?
Yes.
Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
And now The Republic of Conscience. It is published by Blue Rider Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Gary Hart, whose latest book is called The Republic of Conscience. It's published by the Blue Rider Press. We were talking a bit about globalization. Let's talk about foreign policy. It was pretty clear during the Cold War, but then you say everything had to be redefined after the fall of the Soviet Union and then 9/11. Are we still trying to figure things out?
Of course. What happened, it seems to me, starting in 1947 with the passage of the National Security Act, was a fundamental change of America's role in the world. The idea for Truman and others was we don't want to fight World War III, so we're going to leave troops around the world and we're going to keep our hand on top of things so we don't have to redeploy these forces in 20 years from now. But that then led to the surveillance state, not just of what the Soviets were doing, but what American citizens were doing. And to a degree, that also led to what I call the expeditionary state, American troops going into various places around the world, probably starting in Korea and moving all the way up to Iraq.
And pretty much everyone, with a few exceptions, ending in disaster.
You could make that argument.
I mean, we have been the most powerful nation in the world, and yet Korea, Vietnam, we were chased out of Beirut by an explosion. Iraq has been a disaster. Afghanistan hasn't been a complete success. What are the successes? Bosnia?
Well, I would suppose, but what was not recognized by foreign policy planners and some military planners was the changing nature of warfare. We were so used to the big divisions confronting each other and the tank battalions that we should have learned in Vietnam particularly that we were moving to an indigenous, unconventional, irregular kind of warfare. And it took us a long time to begin to adapt to that.
Shouldn't we have understood that because our own revolution was really an insurgency of that sort?
Yes, yes, we should have. But again, you had powerful lobbies for the big army divisions, the big aircraft carrier task groups, the big bombers, and those are all Cold War weapon systems.
You're right, after 9/11, the George W. Bush years were guided by national security, but that the Obama years have been guided by don't do anything stupid.
I'm just reporting the facts. No, I think
is that a foreign policy?
No, it's pragmatism squared. It's make it up as you go along, depending on the circumstances. But we should have taken steps. The Bush administration wanted to dominate the Middle East. That's why we invaded Iraq. It wasn't about weapons of mass destruction, but we're still paying the price for that.
And now we have the whole issue of surveillance, which worries you. But
worries a lot of people.
But a lot of Americans also say surveillance keeps us safe. How many people have told me, well, I don't care if they listen in on what I have to say. I haven't said anything that would get me in trouble.
Yeah. Or they say, as they do to me, I think we ought to monitor people's telephone calls, just not mine.
But they want to monitor yours.
Yes.
Well, you know, if you don't want people to know what you're thinking, you probably should stop writing books.
Yes.
You've written a manifesto for the 21st century for Americans, and in it you include the following. We do not intend to bring force to bear on those with whom we may disagree, and we do not expect them to bring force to bear on us. Do not tread on us, and we will not tread on you. Well, would that work with Al-Qaeda or ISIS or any number of other groups intent on bringing down Western thinking?
They are trying to tread on us, so we have no choice but to respond.
So what do you do when you're dealing with people whose ideas are shocking? Well, I don't know whether beheading people is that much more shocking than waterboarding people, but we're in a very weird extreme situation these days.
We are indeed. Well, what we do is what we're doing in part. We're using artificial warfare. We're using drones. We are not collecting intelligence as we should because we don't know what ISIS' next plans are. We need to know that. It's very hazardous to find that out. We need to form new coalitions, which we're trying to do, but not very successfully, simply because of the 1,300-year divide between Sunnis and Shiites.
On the other hand, it has been pointed out that there has been more homegrown terrorism that had nothing to do with Islamic thinking in this country than more people have died as a result of people like Dylann Roof than the Boston Marathon bombers.
Yes, and shootings in Colorado and the Newtown massacre of 6-year-olds. No, it's
and Charleston.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the list goes on. There are some serious social problems in this country of deranged people having assault weapons.
So is it all just a matter of gun control?
Well, no, I think
because people are being killed all over the world.
Issues. Yeah, these are profound issues. You've got a certain kind of young person. I don't think anybody has figured out why. You hear broken families, you hear failed schools, you hear deranged 20-year-olds that want to kill their parents and everybody else. Whether this is more than usual, you'd have to go back through American history, but they're certainly better armed than they ever were in the past.
My guest is Gary Hart, whose latest book is Republic of Conscience. It's published by Blue Rider Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The basic theme here is that there's an increasing gap between purpose and performance in America.
Well, I would say principle and performance. Our purpose is defined by our principles, who we claim to be and who we tell people we are. And we are asserting one thing around the world, but not but behaving differently. I think the classic of this was the secret bombing of Cambodia. This wasn't a secret to the Cambodians. They were being bombed, and they knew where the bombs were coming from. It was a secret to the American people. So you had officials of our government, elected officials and appointed officials, who were systematically deceiving the American people, because to carry out what they knew the American people would not support if they knew about it. So you have, first of all, have to deceive the American people. Guess what? That causes a loss of confidence in government.
That occurred not long before you wound up running for office.
Yes, it did. Well, Vietnam. My early appointment in the Senate was to what was called the Church Committee, and we uncovered plots to overthrow foreign governments, some of which we knew about, plots to assassinate foreign leaders.
Plots to get Castro's beard to fall out?
Among other things. Yeah, went on and on, and all of it hidden not only from the American people, but from the Congress they elected.
But aren't there rules where they have to inform Congress?
Yes.
Even when they inform Congress, aren't those committees sworn to keep those secrets?
No.
That's what I've heard.
There is no oath of office to serve on the oversight committees. I was a charter member of the Senate Oversight Committee after their Church Committee. Congress now must be notified. If there is to be a major covert operation, the president must sign a piece of paper that led to the Iran-Contra scandal with President Reagan, who claimed not to know about it, but there was a piece of paper in his vault with his signature on it, authorizing it. So that has changed. The members of the Oversight Committee can discuss within the bounds of national security what they learn in their briefings. If they violate national security as they define it, then they are subject to dismissal by the voters.
In your final chapter, Reflections and Afterwards, you tell your own story of getting involved in politics, which began in a civics class when you were in the eighth grade?
Yes.
What about that class inspired you?
It really dealt with what this book's about, what the founders intended for America. And it included not just our rights, but it included the duties of citizenship. And I think that was the difference. And it stuck for some reason. And it carried forward. I did not intend to get involved in politics. My parents were not political. They weren't even graduates of high school. But along came a presidential candidate in 1960 that talked the same language, and it resonated.
We're talking about John F. Kennedy.
Yes.
You write that Jefferson and, to a lesser extent, Hamilton knew that the large-scale republic that they were creating would only survive if citizens did their duty. We are talking about, in the case of Jefferson, a man who is a giant, and then also a slave owner.
A flawed giant, yes. No question.
So did they understand? Do you think Jefferson even understood that dichotomy within himself?
Oh, he did. He talked about having the wolf by the ears, and he knew by punting on the issue of slavery just to get the Constitution adopted that they were kicking the can down the road and that ultimately a price would be paid. He knew that.
Now, many people talked about how political apathy had set in this country, and that seemed to have been suspended during the 2008 presidential race. President Obama's win looked like it would inspire a whole new generation, but that hasn't happened.
Well, you never know. I don't think generations are inspired. I think individuals are inspired.
Well, right now, if you ask voters, they'll say, my vote doesn't make a difference.
Many voters would say that. But I'm thinking about a 20-year-old, an 18 or 20 or 22-year-old who got involved in the Obama campaign and who was motivated by Barack Obama and the first African-American president and the change that represented, particularly from his predecessor, and who may end up running for the Senate or mayor or governor. You just never know what that impact is.
Although what it seems to have inspired more is Tea Party activism.
Well, certainly a reaction to the decision by a majority of the American voters twice to elect a Democrat and a African-American Democrat and one who wanted to institute a public health insurance system. Yes.
I was interested in noting the reaction to the recent Supreme Court rulings, some of which were pleasing to liberals, some pleasing to conservatives. And yet liberals didn't call for the impeachment of the Supreme Court voters who just pretty much undermined the fuel, the power plant emissions ruling of the Obama administration, some of the other things that liberals would have been happy to have seen them vote differently on.
Yeah.
But why do you think every time the Supreme Court votes a certain way, people start screaming impeachment?
Depends on who the people are. I'm trying to remember, as you were asking, I was trying to remember a situation where so-called liberals were trying to impeach Supreme Court justices. I'm sure there were times.
Well, all I remember is Douglas being threatened.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yes. Yes.
But he was a liberal.
Your memory is better than mine. What we're hearing now is Rubio and people like him saying we should elect the Supreme Court. Give me a break. Talk about changing the Constitution.
Do you ever want to run for office again?
No.
What do you want to do? Write books?
I'd like to continue to try to have a small voice and talk to students, which I do a lot, and teach and make a difference. I'm probably different from most former elected officials in that I just can't give up. I know a lot of people wish I would, but I can't.
Well, I'm surprised you never became a lobbyist.
Not 10 cents. I've never made 10 cents lobbying, and I never will.
Gary Hart's latest book is Republic of Conscience. It is published by Blue Rider Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The word spy conjures up images of James Bond and Jason Bourne or memories of Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen's arrests, but not of a grad school dropout working for his parents' business. That's what Naveed Jamali was when the FBI recruited him to give classified documents to a Russian intelligence agent. For 3 years, he served as a double agent, working with the FBI to take down a Russian espionage operation in the U.S. His book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent, is published by Scribner. And I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Jamali to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thrilled to be here.
By the way, written with the help of Ellis Hennigan.
That's right.
How did you start working with the FBI? Did you reach out to the FBI or did they reach out to you?
I reached out to them. We had this sort of odd family connection that started in the late 80s when the Soviets actually approached my parents. My parents ran a small business. It was actually here in New York City at Columbus Circle. And the Russians came in and asked to buy books. And shortly thereafter, the FBI came in and said, what did the man who just came in here with Soviet intelligence, what did he want? And my parents said, well, he wanted to buy some books. And the FBI said, well, get him his books. So there started this.
Any special kinds of books?
You know, they were yes. I mean, this wasn't Harry Potter or things like that. I mean, the man was from the UN. They were books on like nuclear disarmament or arms control, very, very heady, sort of academic, you know, as I joke, things that probably two people a year read, one of whom is the author's mother. So it was.
But they're available in any bookstore,
to some degree,
would probably today be available through Amazon.
Yeah,
or something
some
like
of
that.
The stuff was, but then there was also government reports. But look, I mean, it clearly wasn't classified information, but on the other hand, it wasn't things that, as we found later on, that the Russians necessarily wanted to know that they were interested in.
They wanted copies of proceedings from obscure conferences.
They did. Absolutely. Look, the sort of running way to look at this is to say that your enemies may know what you want, but you only want your friends to know what you need.
But none of this was top secret stuff.
No, absolutely not.
So the FBI, of course, had to trust your parents to be doing what they wanted.
Of course. Well, I mean, there was, the FBI didn't really want them to do anything other than just give the Russians what they wanted, what the books they wanted.
Well, when you went to the FBI, what did you have to do to convince them that they could trust you?
You know, as it turns out, not that much at the onset. This is all about motivation, and I explained to the FBI innocently and genuinely that I wanted to help them simply because I'd applied to become an intelligence officer in the Navy and had been rejected and was reapplying, and I wanted to get simply a letter of recommendation or something for my resume.
Do you know why you were rejected the first time you applied?
Oh,
do they tell you
that? They don't specifically tell you, but I imagine it was, look, I made it to the final round and I didn't have any prior intelligence experience, and I imagine that worked against me.
What about now? You're in the Navy Reserve.
I am.
So are you working in intelligence?
I still am an intelligence officer, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So what did you offer the Russians that your parents were not offering them?
Two things. First is we started to give them more and more interesting things, and that was a feat in itself, to find things that I would organically have access to that I could pass them. And secondly, me. I mean, what the Russians were interested in was not just the information I was providing them, but rather developing a long-term source.
So now they were buying from your parents and from you as well.
No. At this point, my parents were retiring. The reason I approached the FBI is they were retiring. I was taking over the family business, and I approached the FBI and said, look, I'm taking over the account. Perhaps there's some way that I can push the relationship, and in exchange, would you help me?
And in this case, you were thinking about becoming a double agent or just simply continuing what
absolutely.
Your parents were doing?
I was thinking of nothing more than a letter of recommendation for the Navy. That was it. No higher purpose.
Are most double agents amateurs like you?
I can't speak to – I would say that you'd be surprised. Look, here's a basic question. Are most spies amateurs? And the answer is yes. And a double agent is some variation of a spy. There's no training necessarily to become a spy. Perhaps one of the things that surprises most people is that when you say spy, you're not referring to people like Oleg, who was my spy handler. Oleg's job here as a Russian intelligence officer was not to actually spy, but rather to recruit spies for him. So yes, to answer your question, Leonard, most spies are not trained in that field, in that art.
And he was recruiting you to do what?
To spy.
A spy on what?
On anything that I could get my hands on. The Russians, and I imagine most intelligence agencies, are, if nothing else, opportunistic. I mean, they will take whatever they can get.
So you're learning on the job.
Absolutely.
Really. You
bootstrap.
Just have to be clever. He asks you for something, and you have to figure out how to deal with it.
Well, so to be fair, 50% of the discussion is the Russians trying to figure out what use I can be to them. So, I mean, that part of that is to kind of guide them in a specific way.
And what did you guide them to think about you?
Well, part of it was saying what I had access to certain systems, and that there were certain projects that we were running through my company that perhaps might be of interest to them. So it was very much trying to guide them in a very specific and general direction, but letting the Russians take control.
And you had access to things that others might not have?
Yes.
How come?
Through my company. I mean, we that was a whole part of the basis to try to make the Russians believe that we weren't faking it. I actually would get access to certain systems in order to – I mean, we wouldn't tell the agencies, but this was in large part to try to lure the Russians in.
But you had to be sure that you weren't giving them anything that could be of total value. And didn't Oleg's superiors complain?
No. Look, this was the interesting thing, is that this really was like being in a startup. The FBI, to their credit and as I learned later, perhaps it was more that they didn't want their fingerprints on this if anything went wrong. But – they basically would say to me, how do you want to do this? What's the right way to do this? And it really became up to me to sort of figure out, if I was a real spy, how would I really spy? And that was the question that I had to answer all the time.
My guest is Navid Jamali. His book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. You write that you modeled a lot of what you were doing on spy movies.
Absolutely.
Well, what movies were you watching? What were you learning from them? I mean, you're not going to learn much from the Bourne Conspiracy.
So here's the interesting thing is that
– did you buy an MG?
I was always an American car guy. So but what you do learn – look
– an Aston Martin, I guess it was.
Yes, Aston Martin. But what you do learn from spy movies and books is not the art, not the spy craft, but rather – motivation and the character. And what I was using my name. My name was Navid Jamali, and the Russians, I'm sure, knew where I lived, knew what kind of car I drove. Those are not things that I could change. But what I could change was my motivation, why they believed I was doing this. So I couldn't – I was doing it because I wanted simply a letter of recommendation for the Navy, but I couldn't explain that to the Russians. So I had to come up with some motivation that would be believable to their profile. And part of that was to develop a character, and that character was loosely based on – characters from various movies that I had seen along the way.
And in what ways?
Well, I chose – one of my favorite was Michael Mann. Michael Mann's a great director, Manhunter, and Miami Vice, which I think came out in 2006, was one of his latest tomes. And I would actually lift dialogue from the two protagonists, the two police officers who were undercover, and use that dialogue when I met with the Russians. And for whatever reason, it just worked. They believed it, that here's this young American who's materialistic and incredibly, you know, arrogant and egotistical. And, you know, what better way to, you know, convey that than lines from Hollywood?
And that it didn't hurt that you told him that you wanted to get into Navy intelligence.
He thought, of course not.
He thought, well, they
hit the
now
jackpot.
You'll be an incredible source.
Of course.
How did you meet Oleg, your Russian handler? That's not his real name.
That is his real name.
Uh-huh.
No pseudonyms with Oleg. Oleg Kulikov, captain in the Russian Navy and a member of the United, the Russians' mission to the United Nations and part of the military staff committee at the UN. He showed up at my office, simply as that. Look, the Russians for 20 years had been coming to my parents' office. And when I took over, as I said, when I took over that strategic account, he showed up one day.
Did he seem particularly easy to fool? Did he seem particularly competent or incompetent?
Very competent. You know, people ask me, am I scared of the Russians? And look, I look at the Russians now, and certainly as Oleg, as trained, professional, very competent. I mean, look, for someone like Oleg to come to the United States, it's not your first posting. You have to be a senior person. You have to be very good at what you do. And frankly, he was. I mean, he was an incredibly skilled interrogator. When we meet with him, it was nothing short but him interrogating me.
Was the information you gave him all real?
Absolutely.
So you didn't give him anything that the government might have wanted the Russians to know?
No, this was, look, everything that I gave the Russians was things that I would have had access organically through my company. So it was all real.
What was the most sensitive piece of information you gave?
Well, I mean, so when you talk about that, you know, you're thinking about that in the intelligence world, that has a very legal connotation, right? So I'll answer this two ways. The first is, when you say classified, there's no such thing as a classified document. It's either top secret or secret. And frankly, when I got to the Navy, one of the most surprising things is documents that are classified, that have a secret or top secret classification, they may not be that interesting. Just because they have that classification doesn't mean that they're necessarily damaging.
In fact, in some cases, people just stamp everything.
It's overclassified. Absolutely. So there's a huge bucket of things called open source information. And that open source information, as you mentioned, Amazon, a lot of the reports that we were passing the Russians over the years were things like production capabilities or radar, things about radars, very intricate reports that were written at, you know, academia, at Fortune 50 companies. These are real, but they're unclassified. And so to answer the second part about the most sensitive, some of these things were potentially export controlled, which means that they were not to be distributed outside the United States.
Did Oleg give you anything in return for the information?
Of course. He gave me money.
And what happened with that money?
I gave it to the FBI, and they did what they did with it.
Did they pay you for your work?
They didn't pay me for the work, but they did allow me at one point at the end to receive a check and from the FBI, which was very, you know, I was somewhat uncomfortable with it, and even more so uncomfortable with it that you know, what do I do with money from the FBI? And it turns out that you have to declare it on your – I had to declare it on my taxes. So everything was done lawfully. But yeah, it was this weird thing that I can sort of say that in an odd twist, the Russians essentially funded the operation against them.
My guest is Navid Jamali, J-A-M-A-L-I. His book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. It is published by Scribner. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Navid Jamali, who, with the help of Ellis Hennekin, has written a book called How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent, published by Scribner's. Did you record your conversations?
I didn't record them, but the FBI did give me a watch that allowed me to record the conversations for them. A watch, of all things. Now you think about an Apple or a Fitbit watch or something like that. But yeah, that is exactly right. When you talk about trust, the reason, large part, that the FBI was comfortable with me is that they were able to listen in after the fact or real time.
So you were really broadcasting your conversations. Where were you meeting with him?
Only the best of the best for Naveed Jamali. The Russians would take me to essentially chain restaurants such as Pizzeria Uno's and, oh, by the way, Hooters. So if you haven't gone to Hooters with a Russian spy, you haven't lived.
Now, do you think he went to Hooters because he liked the idea of Hooters or because it was the kind of place you could
meet freely?
Not be watching the same way as you would if you were eating at Danielle or La Bernadette.
Right. So the 16-year-old boy in me wants to say that he went there because he liked Hooters. But I think objectively there probably was more to it than that. There was a level of – look, these were sophisticated people. They're concerned about surveillance and counter-surveillance. It wasn't that he just got up in the morning, got into his car and drove and met me. There was very complex method to make sure that he wasn't being followed.
Now, was anything here illegal? After all, you were handing him stuff
was
readily available.
Oh, he's a diplomat. He's not supposed to direct civilians or citizens of other countries to spy. I mean, he was completely committing espionage. It doesn't matter if it's open source or he was directing a person to commit espionage. Completely illegal. And that's – look, no one's surprised that that happens, but it's very rare that you actually catch someone in the act.
Why do you think it lasted 3 years?
In spy world, that's probably not that long. The Russians were looking at – they wanted to build a long-term asset. If I could have continued working for them for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they would have been very, very happy. It takes a tremendous amount of time to develop a source, to trust them, to validate them, to verify them, and then to make them operational. It's a slow dance. There's no rush to it.
And did you realize that you were going to be making such a long commitment when
Absolutely
you started?
Absolutely not. I didn't think any – I had no idea what I was going to get myself into the first time I met with the FBI.
In the spy movies, the real complication is when the double agent wants to meet with the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to do it secretly?
Of course. I mean, the FBI was
did
very –
Did they also want to go to Hooters?
No. Actually, you'll be –
Is that at a park bench? And
well, for the
left
for the,
something by
yeah,
on the bench and
we,
then left.
We absolutely, all kidding aside, we did. We did actually meet. I live in New York City, and they would meet me in various locations in New York. But they were very concerned about meeting with me and making sure if the Russians were tailing me that they weren't seen with me. So,
do you think the Russians were watching you?
Absolutely, I'm sure of it. Now they had to do it in such a way that wouldn't arouse suspicions because. If the people who are watching me are being watched by the FBI, it becomes this crazy thing where you'll drive
yourself
mad.
Sounds like something out of Mad
Magazine. Absolutely. If you start thinking about it too much, you will absolutely go crazy. But there was a level of safety. But for me, this was all comedy. I'm meeting with Oleg, and I understood conceptually that Oleg was a point person of Russian military intelligence, but I didn't see any of that behind him. I just saw Oleg.
But it must have also been stressful for you.
It was, sure.
You're living a double life.
Triple life. I was recently married. I had a career and a job. And then, oh, by the way, I'm a double agent. So it's these three silos. And it's very difficult to keep them separate.
How much did your wife know about this?
She knew about it. But, again, Leonard, the odd thing is we call it the circle of trust. And the only people who knew what I was doing was my wife and two FBI agents. So it's hard to look at this and say that it was the FBI versus the Russians. I didn't see what was behind the FBI's curtain, nor did I see what was behind the Russians' curtain.
How did the FBI ultimately take down Oleg's espionage operation?
They arrested me. I mean, that was the –
They arrested you. That was a staged arrest.
That was a staged arrest. The last time Oleg was supposed to meet with me. Look, diplomats, as is common, they're only at a posting for so long. So after a number of years, he was set to go rotate back to Russia.
And he was planning to go back anyway.
Yeah. But they so what is the impact that has? Well, it has a massive impact because – now the Russians are sitting back as any – they're a professional intelligence agency, and they're going to look back and say, where's the hole? What else has been compromised? They're going to start looking and auditing everything. And so for a brief period of time, they're going to stop collecting information until they can be sure where the hole in the damage is.
Did the staged arrest go smoothly?
No. Part of it did. As is with real life, you plan out as much as you can, and you try to control as much as you can. And the original – plan was for me to meet Oleg and go into one restaurant. And we'd planned out the dialogue, planned out everything, planned out the signal. And I met him at the door. And the first thing Oleg said to me was, hey, Naveed, it's good to see you. Do you want to go to a different restaurant? Which happened to be Hooters, which is an odd twist. So from right there, from the first 10 seconds into it, we had a massive change. And I was I wasn't sure what the FBI was going to do. Were they going to freak out? I wasn't sure what the Russians were going to do. Was I going to walk across? They're going to throw me in the back of a van? It was very nerve-wracking.
But it just was, he decided he wanted to eat at Hooters instead.
Well, I think it was probably an operational decision. No, he probably figured that this is a safety net, change things at the last minute. Did he like Hooters? It's very possible. But I also think there's a strategic decision in there as well.
Now, did you feel any connection to Oleg? Did you like the guy?
No.
So you didn't feel bad for having betrayed him?
No. I didn't betray him. He knew the rules of the game. This is a gentleman's game. They're written and unwritten rules, and he messed up. He got burned, and he knew that coming in here. So that's not to say that I don't have respect for him. I think that he's a patriot and a nationalist in his own right, and I don't have any ill will towards him. But no, I didn't feel any connection to him. It was all business.
Were there any problems along the way? Do you think the Russians ever suspected you? Because during this time, Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned by the Russians while he was working as a double agent.
So I asked the FBI, I said, guys, listen, do the Russians have guns? And they looked at me and they said, it's possible, but we don't think so. And I'm like, what does that mean? Is that a yes or no? So the FBI would never really give me, for questions like that, give me direct answers. So I surmise that it was unlikely that Oleg was armed, and it was even less likely that they were going to do anything to harm me. But yeah, look, there was one point where the Russians wanted me to leave the country with them.
To go where?
To go to Mexico, of all places. And I was concerned that after the fact, the FBI said, that's probably not a good idea. And I thought about it. I said, it's probably right. If I got to a foreign country, things would be very different.
How did you get out of that?
I just think we never—
You said there'd no Hooters down there?
Yeah, that's right. That should have been a good fallback. But they just dropped it. It just never came back up. And I said, I'll think about it. And they never brought it back up again.
Have you given up spying completely?
Spying is the second oldest trade, right? I mean, we spy. I have two kids. It's hard not to, to spy. But look, it's hard to be a double agent or a triple agent or a spy in the traditional sense when, you have a book and hopefully a movie coming out.
If someone wants to become a Navy intelligence officer, would you recommend that they take the path that you
did? No. In fact, I get that a lot. There's a lot of easier ways. And as you said in the onset of the show, go to graduate school. It's safer. It might be more expensive, but you're more likely to get in.
Do you have any advice that you'd give somebody who is becoming a double agent?
when it comes to this sort of work, it's all about motivation. And as long as you understand what your motivation is and what the motivation that you have to project to your adversary, that's the key.
Now, Oleg was arrested, but then he just was shipped back to Russia.
That's right.
Do we know what happened to him?
I have a sense of where it is. And it's. I guess I can say that it's nice to know that regardless of what government you work for, if you mess up, they're going to put you out to pasture. So he's still alive. I'm fairly certain that he's not in the government employ, and he's certainly not doing any intelligence work anymore. But look, he stuck his neck out to say that I was a real spy and got burned on it.
Of course, he wasn't alone. A number of people probably in the embassy or consulate passed on you.
Listen, my parents for 20 years working for the FBI, I'm sure that those people that met with my parents, look, to come to New York as an intelligence officer for the Soviets or the Russians is a senior posting. It's fair to assume that some of those people that worked here are now back in senior positions in Moscow. It's got to be a little bit embarrassing for them.
Your book is being made into a movie.
Yes.
Do you know who's playing you?
I don't. I mean, the only information I have, and I'm very excited about, is that Mark Webb, who did Spider-Man, is the director, and Mark Heyman, who was the screenwriter for The Wrestler and Black Swan, is doing the screenplay for this.
And so you have no idea when the thing is going to go into production?
I don't. That's all I know, unfortunately.
Naveed Jamali has spent more than a decade in the technology management field. He joined the U.S. Navy as a reserve intelligence officer after his period as a double agent. You say you have no intention of going to Russia anytime soon.
Well, it would be a very inexpensive trip, right? You don't have to pay the airfare there. Room and board is included, no airfare back.
His book, written with Ellis Hennigan, is How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. It's published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to a recent study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the number of heroin-related deaths in the United States tripled from 3,086 in 2010 to over 8,200 in 2013, an average of 23 people each day. Addicts increasingly tend to be young and white from rural and suburban areas. In Dreamland, The True Tales of America's Opiate Epidemic, journalist Sam Kanonis looks at how those heroin deaths are directly related to the overmarketing of pain medications in pill mills across the country and how the unfettered growth of highly addictive OxyContin during the 1990s created an ever-growing base of addicts who were lured to cheaper black tar heroin. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sam Kanonis to our show today. Hello.
Very nice to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
What is black tar heroin? Isn't that the kind of the crudest form?
It is. It's a semi-processed form of heroin. I grew up in the 70s watching the great New York movies about heroin, The French Connection, Serpico, and these kinds of things. And for the longest time, I thought heroin only came in white powder form. When I was a crime reporter in Stockton, California, many years ago, I learned that actually that's the most processed, the white powder is the most processed form of heroin. Black tar is the semi-processed, and it's just as addictive, creates just the same kind of withdrawals, the same kind of euphoria. It's just got a lot more impurities in it.
Does that mean that it's less predictable?
No, it's just cheaper.
Now, when did you first learn about Jalisco and the young men who traffic black tar heroin? There are two Jaliscos, aren't there? There's one that starts with the letter J, and there's right. one that starts with the letter X.
And that threw me for a bit, I have to say. Jalisco with a J is an enormous state, the center of which is Guadalajara, very well known. This was a town, I lived in Mexico for 10 years, I'd never heard of Jalisco with an X, Jalisco Nayarit. Nayarit is a small state in Mexico along the coast, Pacific coast. I'd never heard of that town. I heard of it for the first time when I was investigating, as part of a series of stories for the LA Times, how a lot of people were dying of black tar heroin in West Virginia. And it turns out the police in West Virginia were telling me, well, we've got all of a sudden this big surge of black tar heroin from Mexico. There's no Mexicans in West Virginia. I called Columbus, Ohio, which is where a lot of the drugs were coming from, and it was there that a DEA agent told me the story, this strange story of how Columbus had had no heroin until about 10 years before, and all of a sudden these Mexican guys began to come to town, driving around heroin, delivering heroin as if it were pizza, and they were the ones who were selling black tar heroin, and they were all from one town, and that town turns out to be one of the most prolific suppliers of heroin to the United States.
They're functioning like fast food franchises?
Correct.
Are they in competition with each other?
They are. They're in competition with each other and almost nobody else. They go to towns where there's no competition. They don't come to New York City, for example. There's entrenched gangs with guns. Baltimore, they avoid that place, too. They're looking
and
for
And you say
towns
that they don't want to sell to African-Americans.
Right. They're afraid of being robbed. There's a rule almost among these guys from this one town of Jalisco and Nayarit that you don't sell to blacks. They're afraid of getting robbed. So they don't sell to blacks. They also found the white market to be the market, the most affluent market, and that's where they sell.
You write that Christmas Day was big for dealers who opened for business awaiting junkies wanting to exchange for the gifts they or their children had received. So they do barter as well?
What I learned about the Jalisco boys was that they were particularly attuned to customer service. This is kind of where they really made their money. They were not about shooting it out for territory. They were about appealing to the convenience that an addict needed. And so if an addict needed was interested in bartering things, they were open to that idea. They were particularly interested, by the way, especially early on, in bartering heroin for Levi's 501 jeans. This was a startling thing that I realized that in the 90s, when this system, this pizza delivery system for heroin was expanding and they were taking it really nationwide, they began to realize that they could trade black tar heroin for Levi's 501s, that addicts were terrific shoplifters, would go in and clean out a JCPenney's or a Mervyn's or whatever it happened to be, and they would trade those straight across for a hit of heroin.
And then they could take the jeans back to Mexico.
And then they become like Santa Claus. Exactly right. They go home with a big stack of Levi's 501s and give it out to their nephews and their uncles. And it also was important in the spread of this system because as kids back home saw that you could come back home with a ton of Levi's 501s, everybody began raising their hands and saying, hey, I'll do that too. I'll drive heroin around Nashville or Salt Lake City or wherever.
Do the Jalisco boys ever use their heroin?
Never. I've never heard of it happening. They drink a lot. In the United States, I should say, they don't do anything. They don't drink. They don't use drugs. They don't party. They have designed a system that is they've innovated a system that is designed to make them look as if they are the smallest time hustlers on the street.
You tell the story of a young man named Enrique throughout the book. Is he typical of these heroin traffickers?
I think he is in the following regard. He was a poor kid, kind of relegated, humiliated by his poverty and his parents' poverty for many years. And he found in heroin and in this system a way of elevating himself, not only economically, but also socially. So he was viewed with a kind of enhanced reputation back home because he was giving jobs to people. He had money for his family. He built a house. All this kind of, he had a new truck. All these kinds of things come along with heroin. And that's what I found in this town, that heroin kind of levels the social playing field in a sense where people are able to be more equal.
Is it his goal to stay here or to become rich and eventually move back to Mexico?
No, his goal was always to go back to Mexico. In fact, that's what he did repeatedly. He would run the system. He mainly had a system going in a store, they call them stores, a store going in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he would really go back to Mexico a lot because that's where he ran less risk.
My guest is Sam Quiñones. His book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. You're calling this an epidemic. What drugs are classified as opiates other than heroin?
You have a number of synthetic. Obviously, there's morphine, of course, and other drugs that are made from that. Codeine is an opiate as well. There's also synthetic opiates that are derived from drugs that are made from opiates, and one of those is oxycodone. Oxycodone is the drug in OxyContin. OxyContin actually stands for oxycodone continuous, and it's a time release formula that really is the basis of that drug.
But that has to be made by a pharmaceutical, doesn't it?
Right, exactly. That's a legitimate drug, and it has a legitimate medical use.
I would assume that the pharmaceutical company knows that a fair amount of what it's making is being sold illegally.
Correct.
Even rely on the money that comes in from that.
I think you'd have to ask them that, but I would say that's probably a good bet.
Is heroin easier to make than morphine?
I think they're both not so difficult to make anymore. Everybody knows how to make it. They're made in very different ways. Heroin is a folk craft kind of drug. And for example, in Mexico, Chinese immigrants brought the poppy over in the early part of the 1900s. It grows very nicely in certain parts of northwest Mexico. There now is a very deep folk craft in harvesting not first the goo, the opium goo from the poppy, but then, of course, cooking it, in a process that kind of resembles a backyard barbecue, into black tar heroin.
Now, I have poppies in my backyard,
right,
but I couldn't extract heroin.
No, probably because the elevation is not where. I mean, I think this drug, this flower needs a certain elevation to grow and to be industrially, let's say, manufactured.
So I guess I'm not going to augment my salary here.
Probably a good idea.
Have studies been done as to how many times people must take an opiate before they become addicted?
No, I think generally the feeling is that it's different for every person. However, I was overcome by a distinct feeling as I did this book that these are not drugs that can be at all used recreationally. I grew up in the 70s. You could recreationally smoke pot, and it would really not be a problem back then. I think that's changed too. But heroin and these opiates are very, very quickly addict people, and it's a little, in my view, I came to view it as kind of playing with a loaded gun, honestly.
But when it was created, wasn't it first believed that it was not addictive in
Correct.
The late 1800s?
Yes, in fact,
and,
we're seeing...
And cocaine was also seen as an
Exactly. They were looking for... they found this drug to be a perfect for, say, tuberculosis. The way you die of a heroin overdose is that the drug convinces your brain to stop telling your lungs to breathe, So it's a terrific respiratory drug, and it became a drug that people used to suppress tuberculosis cough and so on.
Well, the body is actually built to receive it. Because endorphins are a form of opiate,
right.
And we create them naturally.
Exactly.
So when you take heroin, you're just sending it to the same place.
Except for this is kind of a nuclear blast of endorphins, whereas say cuddling a baby, which also provide you with a certain shot of endorphins is a milder. This is just an overloading of the reward system.
In what ways does heroin, as you write, lend itself to the structured underworld business?
Yeah, it's a good question. What I came to realize was that this, first of all, this is a drug that a consumer, once he is addicted, cannot not buy. So you have a consumer who must buy your product. And not only once a day, but usually five times a day. Heroin turns people into hyper consumers. They start thinking about buying, they buy, and then they start thinking about buying again. And it's the same product over and over again. So you can structure a business pretty much along business school principles.
But wouldn't the opening of methadone clinics have cut into the business of the Jalisco Boys?
In their case... it's in their case, it actually helped because they were the ones who figured out or they were the ones who systematically, let's put it that way, systematically figured out that if they hang out in front of methadone clinics, passing out free samples and the telephone number that you call to get your dope delivered as if it were pizza, that's for many years, the methadone clinics was the only place you could really reliably find opiate addicts. This was before the pills. In places like in the Western United States, that's where you went. That's where you really would find these folks. Later, of course, as the heavy prescribing of opiate painkillers took place, obviously the numbers of addicts proliferated geometrically. But for the first 15, 20 years of this system's life, these guys realized hanging out in a methadone clinic was the place to be.
But before the methadone clinics, there were things like the U.S. Narcotics Farm, where some pretty famous people went to detox. They did studies there. And was that linked to Lexington, where people who were arrested on drug charges were often sent?
Yes, that's the same thing. In the 1930s, the prison system was being overwhelmed by all the drug addicts. They had 20 years before the Harrison Act had made cocaine and heroin illegal. A lot of those addicts who once had not been incarcerated were now being incarcerated. They were undermining kind of the stability of the prisons. And so during the Depression, they built FDR built the narcotics farm, calling it a New Deal for the addict, and in time it became an amazing place, really. It was a remarkable experiment. I mean, you had, first of all, it's probably the most integrated, 100 acres of America, because it brought addicts from all over, and it was Latinos and gay people and blacks and whites and everybody, men and women. It also brought, after Charlie Parker revolutionized jazz with his bebop style of play. He was also a heroin addict, and he created not just a whole legion of terrific players, but players who got addicted to heroin, and huge numbers of them, Sonny Rollins, Elvin Jones.
Rodney, who played with Charlie Parker.
All these guys went to the farm, and they formed, through the years, they formed one of the greatest jazz bands. It was never recorded, but it was a remarkable.
So why was it shut down in the 70s?
I think because it had always been a place where they had done experiments on people, on addicts, and addicts signed up willingly, voluntarily. Hey, I'll be a part of that. You're going to give me free dope. I'll be a part of that. But they became linked to certain experiments run by the CIA on people, and with the Church Commission in the 1970s, they basically shut it down. And it still exists. It's just a medical prison, a federal medical prison now.
Interestingly, in Great Britain, you could be arrested for marijuana, but if you were a heroin addict, you went to a doctor who prescribed the heroin for you, and they felt that was a more effective approach.
Right, and I think that idea kind of also started what I believe to be the beginnings of the hospice movement that brought that, and that came here. It started, I think, first in the UK.
Sam Quinones's latest book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sam Quinones, Q-U-I-N-O-N-E-S. His latest book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, published by Bloomsbury. In 1980, the World Health Organization Cancer Chief established norms for treating dying cancer patients with opiates, primarily morphine. What effect did labeling morphine as an essential drug in cancer pain relief have on public and medical opinion?
I think primarily on medical opinion, it allowed for the use now of this drug in particularly in for terminal patients. That for a long time, particularly in the U.S., there had been this real phobia about these drugs, using them at all for any reason whatsoever.
So people who were suffering terrible pain were still denied any painkillers because they were afraid they were going to make them into junkies?
Precisely. Even though they might have only, 3 to 6 months to live, the fear was more that they would be addicted at death rather than they would live a life of decency free of pain on the last days.
Who was Dr. Russell Portnoy? What role did he play in the promotion of and marketing of opiates to patients?
Right. Dr. Portnoy is a doctor here in New York City. He declined to talk to me for the book, but he is one of the doctors who grew up in this period when opiates were really denied most people. And it was a searing experience that if you're a doctor into medicine to help people and all around you are people who are in excruciating pain and you're not allowed to give them these very humane drugs to relieve that pain, that it can change your life. And he then essentially went on a crusade, I think it's a fair term to use, to liberalize the use of these drugs.
Another influential doctor, Dr. Herschel Jick, and his colleagues submitted a one-paragraph letter to the New England Journal of Medicine that had a major impact.
Yes. Dr. Jick really was tangential to this story, and he didn't expect to be part of this story. But he wrote a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980 saying that he had a database and his data of hospital records, and the hospital records showed that only a very, very less than 1% of all people who were given opiate narcotic painkillers in hospital ever grew addicted to them. He writes this out in a 101-word letter, sends it in. The New England Journal of Medicine publishes it, and he forgets about it because it's not really much of a letter. He himself recognized. I interviewed him. He says this was not a letter that I thought was much of anything. I just thought I'd point this out.
But it's not true.
In his case, it is true. When you use painkillers in hospital, remember, this was from a time when the painkillers were extremely well controlled in hospital. You're only getting small amounts of painkillers to small numbers of people. Then, yes, the addiction rate is small. When, however, what happened was the pain crusaders that grew up in 1980s and into the 1990s used this letter to say, see, these pills, these opiate painkillers are non-addictive, virtually non-addictive when used for pain. But Herschel Jick never meant it that way. He said when used in hospital, when rigidly controlled, they're non-addictive. When you send them home in bottles of 60 or 90 pills to people you haven't tested or you don't know anything about, then there's going to probably be a problem. What happened.
What were the Press Ganey surveys?
They were probably a very good idea that has an unintended consequence. Their survey is...
We're talking about a lot of unintended consequences.
Oh, this is an entire story about that, of those. The Press Ganey surveys are surveys that patients can fill out to say how to let people know how they thought their doctor treated them, whether their doctor was receptive and responsive and et cetera. And that's a very good idea, of course. It's not a bad idea to have some kind of feedback for a doctor. The problem is people began to feel more entitled to be free of pain. That eventually what they began judging doctors based on how many pills they gave them or didn't give them. And bad Press Ganey scores meant that you as a doctor could sometimes be fired or reassigned or you'd have problems from that.
If I were a heroin addict and I was unable to get my heroin, could I take opium or morphine and get past the problem?
Sure.
Are they interchangeable?
They are.
The reason I ask is now we come to OxyContin.
Right.
Now, OxyContin is not a real opiate because it doesn't come from poppies.
No, but it's synthesized from pills that do come
from. Why was it even developed if you already have an awful lot of opium out there on the market? Afghanistan alone probably could supply every person in pain in the world 100 times.
It really was designed not to be an opiate. It was designed to deliver opiates in an opiate painkiller over a period of 12 hours. Before OxyContin, it was a game changer in a few ways. Number one, it allowed a pain patient to only take two pills a day. That's a huge change. That's a life-changing event if you only have to take two pills a day, and it kind of leaks the drug into your system. The drug it does this with is oxycodone, which was developed in the early part of the 1900s. But because it contains no other abuse deterrents, like Vicodin contains Tylenol and acetaminophen to limit the abuse of it. It's just straight dope. So once you, as a street user, can suck off the time-release coating around the pill, then you have a full whack of dope.
And you crush it and...
I'm sorry?
Do you crush it into a powder?
Yeah, if you can do that, you could just take it. You could just take it orally. You could crush it into a powder. You can smoke it, or eventually what people, as their tolerance grew, people began shooting it up. And this provided the bridge between the earlier painkillers like Vicodin and Percocet and Lortab and heroin, because you had this bridge that would take you... Most people who would abuse Vicodin or Lorset or Percocet wouldn't really transition to heroin, but now you had a bridge that would take you there.
Was the pharmaceutical company that developed it, Purdue, Frederick, aware that it was being abused?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, I think you'd have to ask them that, but I think that there was eventually a realization, yes, that this was not a drug that was virtually non-addictive.
And then we had things like Rush Limbaugh being arrested for buying it illegally.
What ended up happening was doctors bought into the idea, promoted by pain specialists, that there was a very, very minimal risk of addiction when you use these pills. And there was this rising sea level nationwide of pills all across the country. People then became addicted to them, a lot more people than they ever expected. And the result is what we have today.
And you found that Oxy prescriptions for pain rose from 670,000 in 1997 to 6.2 million in 2002. I imagine it's even higher today.
Right. They're selling, according to a Fortune magazine article, they're selling $1 billion worth of that drug every year.
Are some doctors now reluctant to prescribe
it? I think that's
it?
Growing, yes. I think people across the country are saying, gee, maybe we ought to check this. The problem is that you get into the kind of the pendulum swinging too far the other way, where you do have people who have legitimate chronic pain who do need these pills. These do have a medical use, and they're now having a more difficult time getting them prescribed.
My guest is Sam Quinones. His book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What kinds of pains are we talking about Oxy being prescribed for?
Well,
sore knees,
yes.
Fibromyalgia, things like that?
All that kind of stuff. One of the most startling I learned was that when you get your wisdom teeth out, you're now given these pills. And it depends on the dentist which one he gives you, I think. But I would say also one new very sadly fertile terrain for addiction is athletics, high school and college athletics. Football is now almost a gateway to heroin addiction, because football and lacrosse and other sports of that kind are accompanied by lots of pain, lots of chronic pain throughout a season. You're hurt, it doesn't heal. And so what you're finding now is a lot of athletes have become addicted to this stuff. And a lot of it, I think, also is due to the fact that there's a great pressure to get them to play again, get them back on the field. They want to get back on the field. They're demanding it. There's not a lot of education about how dangerous these drugs are, and that maybe really the solution, sadly for you, quarterback, is to just stay off the field for a while.
And are the Jalisco boys aware of that? Are they selling it to athletes?
Yeah, it's always a good question how much these guys know about why they have such a great market.
Because they seem to have scouts who bring them into areas where there's a potential market.
Everywhere they've gone, they've been led there by addicts who they've been paid in heroin. Now, Some of these guys certainly have understood the pill market. In fact, the Jalisco boys were the first ones to exploit the emerging pill market, primarily in the Columbus, Ohio, West Virginia, eastern Kentucky region.
You write about the town of Chillicothe, Ohio.
Right. In late 1998, a guy arrives there with a system in Columbus, and he begins to understand that the pill market will create a much, much larger market for of addicts than they've ever had the access to back in the West Coast. And he expands there. Now, how many of the drivers who speak no English, who were there for 9 months and just really want to go back with some money, how much of the pill market they fully understand, I'm not quite sure.
But it sounds to me like the Jalisco boys understood that if you take these pill addicts and you help them, they will transition to the black tar heroin that they specialize in.
Exactly. And they also specialize in keeping an addict going, in a sense. They have a whole bunch of come-ons, discounts, free giveaways that as soon as an addict looked as if he's about to quit, boom, they're right there with free dope. Or as soon as the addict gets out of jail after being clean for a while, boom, they're right there getting using again.
What did the local police in the towns that you visited tell you about opiate abuse? How did they deal with addicts and drug dealers?
You know, it's all over the map. I mean, obviously, every place you go, I found it to be a nationwide story.
I think a cop is calling you right now. Your phone just went off.
There we go. The story is the same. Every place you go, all our addicts are young or getting younger. They're all white. And by the way, they all start with pills, and eventually they have to transition. If they don't get treatment, they transition to heroin.
But the first pushers, in a way, are the pill mills, aren't they?
Let me put it this way. This is the first drug scourge we've had since World War II, the post-World War II era, that has not come from the mafia or the underworld or street drug traffickers. If you think about cocaine and crack, that came from Colombians, and then the Bloods and the Crips very famously shot it out for territory all across America. This is the first drug scourge that comes really instead from over-prescribing of legitimate medication.
And doctors doing it knowing that they're doing something wrong?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, let's say Dr. David Proctor.
There are some who are scandalous, like Dr. Proctor, who then did 12 years in prison and just recently was released. Sure, there's pill mills across the country. I believe most doctors, 99%, I dare say, across the country, want to help their patients, and they do that. They prescribe these painkillers for that reason, because their patients are demanding a resolution to their pain problems.
Many of the people who you're talking about who become addicted are in red states. And how are local politicians dealing with it? Republicans have traditionally taken a hard line attitude toward drug addiction.
Yes, I'm about to embark on a story that gets into more detail about that for a magazine. But the idea is certainly true that the more addicts you see around you that you know, that you went to church with, maybe it's your son or a nephew or a business partner's son or daughter or what have you, it sensitizes people. And so what I think has happened in a lot of areas where they thought the issue of crime and punishment and prison and rehab was settled, and the kind of the throw away the key attitude was really the one that predominated, those attitudes are now getting really reassessed in very deep ways. You see, the state of Kentucky has just passed a heroin law that allows for needle exchange. You see these kinds of movements all related to the fact that we have now a widespread addiction, largely of young white kids.
So they're seeing their own kids and neighbors become addicted.
Yeah.
And then in Washington state, the state's attorney general took Purdue to court in 2007. What was he?
No, it was in Virginia. In Virginia, they took the federal attorney, the U.S. attorney in Virginia, took Purdue to court filed a criminal charges against them for misbranding. Eventually, the company pled guilty to one misdemeanor charge of misbranding, paid a $634 million fine. That's the only time it's been so charged.
So do the Jalisco Boys continue to operate their cells throughout the United States?
They do. They do. They're I think, doing gangbusters. I would say that the big difference now is, however, that the entire underworld is aware of this pill to heroin phenomenon. I think this is all over the place. The big cartels in Mexico have definitely figured it out. I think a lot of other minor dealers around this country. And so
the old drug dealers, the mob.
And also every addict that you create is a potential dealer, because eventually you can't work to support your habit. You're going to have to sell. And so what's happened now is they are sharing those markets that they once had, I would say, you know, pretty much dominance over. They're having to share those markets now with a whole bunch of other folks.
Mm-hmm. And some people go to jail for abuse. Others wind up with nationally broadcast radio shows. But
the great irony of American life. Do we see
have judges been adjusting to the situation?
I think the increasing use of drug courts is happening across the country, where instead of slapping a felony on somebody, you go through drug court, you go through NA, you do a lot of things, jump through a lot of hoops over a period of a year or two, and you get that felony expunged. People are understanding now, particularly in communities, rural and suburban communities, that you have you have a felony on your record. It's about as life mangling as a heroin addiction.
The reason I ask is because whenever you look at prison populations, so many of the people there are African Americans or Latinos who have been sentenced, given long sentences for right. drug abuse of one sort or another. But I'm getting a feeling that there's a kind of a double standard here.
It's possible. I think what's happened is, you know, I think it's very similar to what's happened with gay marriage. You know, that people begin to know the realities, you know, that they had the luxury of never knowing before. And now they see it up front and up close and personal. And it's changing a lot of hearts and minds. And I'm in my charitable moments, I call it a kind of a Christian opening, let's call it that.
Okay, let's end on that positive note.
There you go.
Sam Quinones, his latest book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's been great to be here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.